As of April of this year, Fayette County has had a new health commissioner. With so many health-related issues in the news, we are taking time today to visit with Dr. Craig Humbaugh to discuss the major health issues in our region and in the Commonwealth, and whatever else is on his mind regarding our common health. On this week's Eastern Standard, a one-on-one with Fayette County Health Commissioner Dr. Craig Humbaugh. We are interested in your questions, your comments, or your personal stories. We encourage you to write to us right now by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. You can send a tweet at WEKUEST, and anytime you can post on the WEKU website or the Facebook page. In just a little while, we'll open the phone lines as well, again, for your questions, your comments, your personal stories on matters of health. It is time for Eastern Standard, right after the latest news from NPR. From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen. Today, a unique opportunity, one that we've not taken advantage of yet on this program in the 3 years that we've actually been on the air with the program. We're going to have a one-on-one with Fayette County's Health Commissioner, Dr. Craig Humbaugh, and we're interested in interacting with you about what is on your mind regarding health issues. It seems that every day we're hearing another story in the news that is about some matter, some element of health, and it ranges from drug abuse through obesity, through specific problems that are specific to our area. Of course, concerns about the Zika virus and the annual push to get everybody vaccinated against the flu or influenza. We're interested in hearing from you, your questions, your comments, your personal stories throughout today's program at wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at wekuest. You can always post on the Facebook page or the website, or we'll open the phones up right now and let you know the number, but it'll be a little bit before we get your call on the air. Feel free to call in right now and be part of the show. If you have a question or a comment for Dr. Craig Humbaugh, 800-621-8890. That's 800-621-8890. And Dr. Craig Humbaugh, thank you so much for taking the time to spend an hour with our listeners.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here, John.
You've been a guest on the program before, but in your previous role,
right,
with the Commonwealth of Kentucky. What caused you to all of a sudden switch roles and come to Lexington and Fayette County as our health commissioner?
Well, this was a really very attractive opportunity for me. Lexington has a lot to offer, world-class health care, wonderful community with a lot of resources, and a lot of resources that can be pointed toward improving health in the community. Great board and wonderful staff at the Lexington Fayette County Health Department.
Were you, when you were hired, given a mission, like these are the things we want to be working on? I assume you report to a board?
Yeah, sure. So I report to a board that's mayor and council appointed. And fortunately, I've been given some latitude. I'm kind of in the listening and learning stage right now, listening to board members, to staff, to the community about what concerns are and learning about what our priorities should be in Lexington.
What are you seeing? What are the major issues, the major underlying concerns for health in Fayette County and Lexington? And of course, WEKU serves a much
right.
wider area in central Kentucky. So obviously you don't have jurisdiction, if that's the right term, over
yeah.
Hazard, Pineville,
yeah.
or Corbin. But what happens in Lexington does affect
much of
eastern Kentucky.
Well, I think first we have to look at, well, what do we consider health? What is health? And, you know, in my mind, health is not just the absence of sickness, but it's really a state of well-being, of spiritual, physical, and emotional well-being. And there are a lot of things that drive health in our communities in central Kentucky. We talk about social determinants of health, but that can be poverty, it can be transportation, education, genetics, environmental factors. All those things help to drive health, and they can help influence the health of what's going on in our area. I think, obviously, some of the things we're going to talk today about are major factors that are contributing to our health, and those include substance abuse and some of the related bloodborne illnesses that can be associated with substance abuse, obesity, and our lifestyle issues, smoking, and tobacco use, and of course, physical activity as well.
You mentioned substance abuse, and I think we absolutely have to address the issue of a giant issue and concern that's come up in just the last couple of weeks. What do you know about this epidemic, as some have described it, of heroin overdoses and deaths that have occurred? Hundreds, I guess, in the Cincinnati area. Is it dozens in the Lexington area at this point?
Well, I'm not as familiar with the recent activity and what's driving that. However, I know about the overdoses that have occurred. But what I would say is that this is something that's been building, unfortunately, in our state and in central Kentucky. If you look at drug overdose numbers, they have almost doubled in Fayette County alone from 2011 to 2015. And as this is probably no surprise to your listeners, but Kentucky has one of the highest rates of drug overdose deaths in the nation of any state, and that is driven by substance abuse issues here in the Commonwealth.
I mean, there's talk about this heroin epidemic maybe being related to some bad heroin or the dealers who are providing it, mixing it with poisonous substances and so forth. What does a health department do about things of that nature? Obviously, we're talking about something that's unregulated. It's not like you can increase inspections.
Control
the quality somehow.
Certainly. And these are illegal drugs, and what we're hearing is more and more of heroin that's being sold on the street is being cut or being added to with fentanyl, which is another opioid. So these are both types of drugs that cause highs, and they're related to opioids like you would get from poppy, like morphine. Unfortunately, fentanyl is a drug that is able to produce even a stronger high, and so that's why it's sometimes being mixed in. I think our concern is that folks who are buying these products on the street, unlike prescription drugs or prescription opioids or opiates, are not able to tell what the exact dosage is that's going to make them high or give them that high. And so it's really a situation that's more ripe for overdose because they're not able to control, you know, what the amount is on what they're getting illegally on the street.
Where does heroin and opioid abuse fit in the picture of abuse of drugs? And I know there have been serious efforts in Kentucky and elsewhere to control prescription drug abuse. Marijuana has been around for a few decades, and I understand that comes and goes in trends. Is there a general picture of the nature of abuse? Like, what is heroin and opioid? Is that the top of the list right now? Is the biggest issue?
Heroin and illegal substances are rising, especially in urban areas, as the drug that folks are overdosing from. Unfortunately, in rural areas of the state, there are still high rates of overdoses from prescription drugs. Some of those are also opiates.
I mean, we hear about meth labs and methamphetamines. Is that still an issue? And people who are cooking and creating their own?
Certainly, but we're seeing definitely a rise in illegal heroin, fentanyl, and other drugs of that nature, especially in urban areas.
Now, what's the relationship between the health commissioner and drug enforcement? I mean, is there a direct relationship?
So I think, you know, we're interested in anything that affects the health of the population, and when we see this rapid rise in the number of drug overdoses, that concerns us. And our other concern is the attendant potential for outbreaks due to bloodborne pathogens that can be spread through dirty needle use or injection drug use. Let me explain that a little bit more. So when I say bloodborne pathogens, it's just a fancy word for saying germs that can be spread through the blood, through sharing blood, one person to another. And sharing a needle that's been injected into one person, then injected into another person without being cleaned, being a used needle, can unfortunately spread those germs. For instance, HIV spreads that way. So does hepatitis C. So can hepatitis B. So there are a variety of different, unfortunately, serious bloodborne illnesses. Hepatitis C is actually the most common bloodborne illness in Kentucky. We're also, unfortunately, number one, or at least we were, and if you look at 2013 data in the number or the rate, I should say, of acute hepatitis C cases in the country. So our rate was the highest in the country in 2013. And the primary risk factor for new cases of hepatitis C is injection drug use or sharing dirty needles.
And so hepatitis C, HIV, and so forth are the reason for needle exchanges? Let's talk about the philosophy and the mechanics behind that. Mm-hmm.
So needle exchanges are, in my mind, one kind of what we call harm reduction tool, and the primary reason for them from a public health standpoint is to try to prevent the spread of these bloodborne illnesses like HIV and hepatitis C by helping to provide clean needles to a population of injection drug users. Studies have shown that they do not increase drug use in communities, and in fact can be a very successful tool to decrease the spread of these types of illnesses. They are not in themselves magic bullets. They're used in combination with other types of strategies in communities to decrease the spread of illness and to prevent overdoses. Some of the benefits also from them is that they help to, because there's a place for drug users to bring their dirty needles in, they can help to keep dirty needles off the streets for the public and for law enforcement officers. And they're also a place for people when they decide to get clean, that there's a trust relationship built with the staff at these clinics, like our needle exchange clinic in Lexington, and they can then get substance abuse counseling and treatment can be offered for those folks, referrals to substance abuse counseling and treatment.
We want to talk more about needle exchanges. We want to talk about the Zika virus and the flu vaccination. It's getting to be that season of the year once again. Already can see the signs at the little clinics and the supermarkets and the drugstores encouraging flu vaccinations. We want to talk about those matters and other health-related issues on your mind. We have with us Fayette County Lexington Health Commissioner Dr. Craig Humbaugh, and you are invited to be part of our program. Send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKUEST. Or pick up the phone now and call, and we'll be glad to get you on the air with your question, your comment, or your personal story. 800-621-8890. It's Eastern Standard with Dr. Craig Humbaugh on the WEKU stations.
Give me the news, I got a bad case of loving you. No pills gonna cure my ill, I got a bad case of loving you.
We have the doctor with us in the studio on this week's Eastern Standard. Dr. Craig Humbaugh is health commissioner for Lexington, Fayette County. And he is here to interact with you. If you have questions, comments, personal stories about anything we're talking about or anything else on your mind as far as health issues in our region, and certainly we don't want to limit that to Lexington and Fayette County. So if you are in Madison County or if even in Pike County, if you're anywhere in eastern Kentucky listening to WEKU, please feel free to be part of our show, 800-621-8890. Send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com, and you can send us a tweet at WEKUEST. Dr. Craig Humbaugh, we were talking briefly about needle exchanges, and I know we've talked about that on this program before, and WEKU News has covered the needle exchange program. What's the current status? Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes the needle exchange stuff gets controversial because folks can bring in one needle and walk out with multiple mm-hmm. needles. Is that the way it works right now?
Well, our program is about a year old. We're actually coming up on our one-year anniversary, and I would say that, thanks to the previous commissioner, Dr. Rice Leach, and to the staff and to the mayor and city council, they were able to start this program, which has only been allowed by law since 2015. And now we've seen about 300 unique clients for around 900 visits as of early in August. Our clients have brought in just about as many needles as have been distributed to the clients. So we're at, I believe, around a 92% or 95% exchange rate. In other words, almost a one-for-one. Early on, when clients first come in, there is a greater need for them to have more needles, because that's the whole idea of the clinic, is to make sure that they have clean needles each time they inject. But as they become more established clients, they will bring those needles back to us and others that they're using to inject in a safe manner.
I mean, the very nature of needle exchanges is somewhat controversial because you're I'm trying to think of the right term, but you're cooperating with people who are doing illegal things.
Yeah, and again, I want to stress that the data would show that these types of programs are primarily set up to prevent the spread of HIV and hepatitis C.
It's a public health matter.
They do not show, the data does not show that they encourage or increase drug use in communities.
And that's one of those issues. You're welcome to be part of the conversation. Our listeners are welcome to join in if you have a comment about issues such as needle exchanges. 800-621-8890, WEKUEasternstandard@gmail.com, or send a tweet at WEKUEST. Switching gears a little bit from needle exchanges, and of course, if you have questions about how that works, please be part of our conversation. But the Zika virus is in the news a lot. And I know, mm-hmm. again, every time we talk about Zika virus, you come back to saying, but don't forget about the flu, because Zika virus, have we had cases of Zika virus?
So there have been cases in Kentucky, but they're all travel related. So these are people who have been to areas where the virus is circulating in the mosquito population. That is mainly in areas of the world like South America, Central America, and the Caribbean. But as your listeners have probably heard recently, there are selected very small areas of Florida where mosquito populations have been infected, and there's been local transmission. But we've had no local transmission here in Kentucky of the virus.
Is there any risk? Mm-hmm. I mean, when we go out on one of these early September evenings mm-hmm. and enjoy an evening for a walk or sit in a park or recreational activities, have a picnic or whatever, and you get bit by a mosquito, is there any reason to be fearful about that you're going to get this terrible virus?
I think at this point, mosquito population in Kentucky is unlikely to see Zika this particular mosquito season, but it could be a potential for next mosquito season. What I would say is that folks should always take precautions to getting bit by mosquitoes, so reduce their likelihood of being bit by dressing appropriately, wearing light long sleeve clothing, wearing appropriate FDA approved mosquito repellent when they're out, especially at dawn and dusk when mosquito activity is at its highest peak. And the reason for that is not only are we potentially worried about Zika in the future, but we have mosquito-borne illnesses now, like West Nile and others that are already circulating in our endemic mosquito population here in Kentucky.
I mean, if a person has recently been exposed to mosquitoes, know that they were bit, you know, we grew up as kids. We were kids. We got bit by mosquitoes all the time and thought nothing of it. But someone gets bit by a mosquito today, I guess they're going to have a concern. When do you take that concern into the medical office and to go see your doctor or to an emergency room?
Well, the main concern about Zika is really for pregnant women. So the majority of folks who have contracted Zika virus, and again, that's mostly people who are not, that they haven't gotten it in Kentucky, they're folks that are in other parts of the world mainly, they're not symptomatic. In other words, most of them don't have any symptoms at all with this particular virus. Sometimes they have fever, rash, or joint aches. But the main concern we have about Zika is this is the first time that we've ever seen a mosquito-borne illness that can cause birth defects in pregnant women. If the pregnant woman is exposed and gets this virus while she's pregnant, she can deliver an infant that has potentially neurological defects such as microcephaly, which is small head size, and other neurodevelopmental problems. And that's a big concern for us globally, and again, could become a concern for us at some point in the future if our mosquito population becomes infected. We do have the mosquito that is driving the epidemic in other areas of the world, like the Caribbean and in Central and South America. However, it's present here in the Lexington and Central Kentucky area in relatively low numbers. It's called Aedes aegypti. We also, however, in greater numbers, have its cousin, which is called Aedes albopictus. In the lab, this mosquito has been shown, this cousin has been shown to be a potential vector or spreader of Zika. But I think we don't know in the wild, in this environment, whether it's going to be the type of mosquito that can drive an epidemic. And so I think the jury is still out, and this is an evolving situation. If we said from the beginning about Zika, scientists are learning more, but it's certainly a potential threat for us either later this mosquito season, but more likely next mosquito season.
Am I correct that Fayette County has taken efforts to make steps to a mosquito abatement, I guess?
Yeah. Really, that's the number one way to get rid of mosquitoes is to get rid of standing water. And eliminating standing water is really everybody's responsibility. It's the community's responsibility because these are mosquitoes that don't travel very far from where they're hatched. So they live and die within like a 300-yard radius from where they're born.
Now, what do you mean when you talk about standing water, though? We have rivers and we have lakes and we have ponds. I mean, are we talking about those bodies of water?
No, we're actually talking about maybe very small pools of water. So let's say a plastic toy is left outside and there are a few tablespoons of water in the summer when temperatures are high and the life cycle of the mosquito is very short. You could have a new crop of mosquitoes in a relatively short time that breeds in just a few tablespoons of water. So it's things like people's gutters, plastic materials left outside, old tires left outside, abandoned swimming pools. Those are the kinds of standing water, bird baths that aren't routinely, the water isn't routinely changed. Those are the types of standing water that we really want to eliminate.
So this really comes down to a homeowner issue.
It really is. It's a true public health, environmental health issue. The other alternative is if standing water can't be eliminated, then there are products that can be added to the water called larvicides, and these prevent mosquitoes from hatching in those local bodies of water. And then, of course, we also have a mosquito fogging or spraying program. It does have some utility, but the utility is limited in that it's only going to affect or kill kill mosquitoes that are around on the evening that we fog. And it's only going to affect those mosquitoes that are flying in the air at that time. So although it's one tool we have in our toolbox, the more effective tools are to eliminate standing water or to do larvaciding.
One last question from me, at least, on the mosquitoes and Zika virus. How is Madison County prepared if there were an epidemic? Is there a vaccine or is there a cure for Zika virus? Mm-hmm. What happens if all of a sudden, let's say next year, we find out that there is a widespread problem with Zika virus?
Mm-hmm. And there isn't a cure, and that's why we are really hammering home the point that we need to prevent this particular virus. And the way to prevent it is to eliminate mosquito breeding grounds.
But if there's an epidemic, is there what are the emergency rooms and
again,
the hospitals prepared?
Most folks are not symptomatic, and our main concern is pregnant women who get this particular virus, who could pass it to their child and could see birth defects in their children.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. At Lexington, Fayette County Health Commissioner Dr. Craig Humbaugh with us this morning. And he's glad to answer your questions, to hear your comments, to hear your stories. Health-related matters, of course. 800-621-8890 is the number. You can send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com, or send a tweet at wekuest. Not quite an Ask the Doctor program, but the doctor's here. You can ask him something. Feel free to jump on board at 800-621-8890. All right, more concern to you and to health professionals than something that's somewhat theoretical like the Zika virus is the good old-fashioned influenza, the flu. And again, I referred to the fact that, you know, when we were kids, we'd get bit by mosquitoes and we didn't worry too much about it. People would get the flu and we didn't worry too much about it. Why are we so doggone concerned about the flu these days?
Well, as you mentioned, John, flu is an outbreak that we face or confront every single winter season, every year. And flu is kind of a wily or changeable virus in that it changes its genetics as a survival technique. And so it changes them just enough that the body sees that as a different virus and can become infected. So antibodies from previous flu or flu shots don't always 100% help us protect us from this year's new flu season strain.
By way of clarification, so if I had a flu shot last year, which I actually did,
good.
If the flu that came back this year was exactly what I was vaccinated for, inoculated for last year, would that still be effective?
You would be good, but the problem is that we often see different strains that are circulating each different season. They change their genetics just a little bit. And that's why scientists try to anticipate what those new flu strains might be, and they try to include that as coverage in each New Year's vaccine. That's also why you need a new flu shot every year, because there is going to be usually new flu strains that are circulating every flu season.
So when is the flu season? And when does the concern begin, and when is it too late?
Our flu season here in Kentucky is usually October through May. So right now we're into flu vaccination season, because it does take a couple of weeks after a person receives his or her vaccination for the body to develop antibodies against influenza. So for that protection to develop, it takes a couple of weeks. So we need to think about getting flu shots and flu vaccination before flu season earnestly hits here in Kentucky. And for many people, the flu is simply a nuisance, but CDC estimates that it depends on the severity of the season, but anywhere between 3,000 and 49,000 people actually die of flu and flu-related complications in the U.S. During a flu season.
Any idea the numbers in Lexington, Fayette
County? I don't know. It's really hard to estimate that at a local level, but certainly we have documented flu people who die of flu each year. usually the majority of folks, the folks who are most vulnerable to death from the flu are the elderly and those with chronic illnesses. But unfortunately, we do see young persons as well that are also affected severely by influenza. And then I would say that not only is there the human cost, but there's also the economic cost of flu, which is another reason to prevent the flu. So it's just the matter of time that people stay home from work to take care of themselves or their loved ones when they get the flu. So we haven't really mentioned this, but we've been talking around the fact that the best way to prevent the flu, the number one way, number one defense, is to get a flu shot each year. It's not always, it's like any other vaccination, it's not 100%, but it is the best defense that we have.
How widely available are the flu shots? I mean, I know a lot of our health plans cover them. A lot of places advertise, you know, your flu shot for $20 or whatever, and that's a relatively small expense. I mean, are there public programs to make sure that everyone can have access to flu shots, whether or not they have insurance?
There are, and there are a wide variety of places that give it. So this year we expect an ample flu supply again, ample flu vaccine supply, I should say. We will be doing what we call our free flu shot clinic at the Lexington Fayette County Health Department on October 20th. Watch our website for locations and times for that. But I would also say that the flu vaccine is widely available, more so than ever, at health departments, at doctor's offices, at clinics, at pharmacies in the Central Kentucky area.
When your doctor says, hey, have you had a flu shot, and encourage you to get a flu shot, who are the folks who are most at risk and really should pay attention to that advice? I mean, I will confess to being one. When I was a younger person, I just always resisted and thought, eh, why bother? There was a point at which, and it wasn't really all that long ago, that I kicked over and said, okay, I'll go ahead and take it. Now, have I noticed, you know, it's one of those things, I haven't had the flu, so do I know that was the vaccine that did it, or is it just still
good health habits?
Yeah, still a matter, and that's not necessarily very documented. But when do we know you really, really, really and truly want to make sure that you're getting the flu shot?
Well, almost everyone 6 months of age and older is recommended to have a flu vaccination each year. But certain people...
I was thinking more like 60 years.
Certain people, folks who are older than 50, folks with chronic illness, so that could be asthma, that could be heart disease, folks who are pregnant, healthcare workers are all especially recommended to have a flu vaccination each year.
We'll come back and continue talking about flu vaccination and other health concerns on this week's Eastern Standard. Your questions, your comments, your personal stories invited. WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKUEST or give us a call. Lines are open right now for Dr. Craig Humball, 800-621-8890.
Day or night, he'll be there any time at all. Dr. Roberts.
Dr. Craig Humball is with us. He is Health Commissioner for Lexington Fayette County. And he's here for this week's Eastern Standard, talking about medical and health-related matters. You're welcome to be part of the conversation. WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKUEST or give us a call at 800-621-8890. We've been talking about the Zika virus. We've talked about flu vaccination. We've talked a little bit about the heroin and opioid drug addiction issues. What are the health issues and that are on your mind? And what do you wish public health officials such as Dr. Craig Humball were doing? What do you think of the health programs that we have available in the Commonwealth of Kentucky and in our nation? Again, that number, 800-621-8890. Now, I did have one question, taking us back to the issue of Zika virus and mosquito-borne illnesses. And the question from listener Adam was, he says, I don't understand why ponds are not a concern. Can your guest clarify? We're concerned about bodies of water. Aren't there mosquitoes in ponds?
Sure. I'm not an expert in this area, but what I understand is if the ecosystem in the pond is correct and there are fish and everything that's living in harmony, then there are natural predators for mosquito larvae in ponds.
Is that frogs?
And that they eat those larvae, and that that can reduce mosquito populations that come from ponds or those types of natural bodies of water.
I guess if you're a fisherman, you like spending time around those bodies of water, it's probably not a bad idea to use some kind of repellent.
Certainly for anyone who's outdoors.
We were talking about the flu vaccination and availability of flu vaccines. Who pays for that stuff? When you talk about free clinics and you talk about free availability of such services, and this happens a lot in urban areas, Lexington, of course, and Louisville, and I'm sure in other cities across the Commonwealth of Kentucky, when we see the word that the flu shots are available at no charge, did I pay for that somehow in my tax dollars?
And you did, because you know they're supported from the money that we get from local, state, and federal taxes that come to local health departments, and we try to put that money to best use that we possibly can, use our limited resources to do the most good in our communities.
We hear from time to time again some of these well-recognized or infamous strains of flu. H1N1 was one that came out a number of years ago, and there was a big push about that and a lot of media discussion about that. What became of that? Did that go away?
It did not. So strangely, it has continued to circulate. But most of us now have either been vaccinated or we have had a strain of the H1, so we have some immunity that's been built up. So it was a pandemic strain. It was a brand new strain that was very much unlike strains that we had seen before in the past as a country and as a world. But those strains eventually become the more common circulating strains. And again, in this year's seasonal influenza vaccine, there's going to be a component of it that will protect against H1N1.
And on the other side, we're talking about vaccines. That's one form of medical care, prevention. There's a lot of discussion lately about the cost of health care, and of course, the whole Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, Kentucky's Connect program, and the changes that the Bevin administration is making for the Medicaid program and so forth. What's happening in terms of health care costs? I mean, medications are a major part of that. And as I understand it, for instance, the cost of medications is not regulated. The companies, the pharmaceutical companies, can provide a product that may be really essential in some people's lives and charge a tremendous amount of money for that. Is there any movement toward somehow getting a handle on that? Or from your point of view as a physician for a couple of decades, as I understand it, are we getting better in that regard in terms of affordability of healthcare, or are things getting even more complicated?
Well, at least in Kentucky, the Affordable Care Act and expansion of Medicaid have meant that more people than ever have access to health care. There is still controversy about, as you've said, about specific drugs that may be fairly expensive for folks. Plans sometimes do cover those drugs. Sometimes there are certain pre-authorization clauses put on those receiving those types of drugs. As you said, there's been controversy recently in the news about some drugs like hepatitis C treatment drugs or epinephrine, where the cost has gotten relatively high and or higher than it has been in the past. So I think it's this whole issue of how do drug companies potentially recoup their research and development costs, but then how do we make it affordable for people to get these life-saving medications that they need? So it's certainly a continuing health issue for us. But the Affordable Care Act and the fact that more people have insurance, I think, is helping more people have access to good care and to medications that they've ever had before. And that's one of the things that we do at the health department. That's one of our missions, is making sure that our most vulnerable populations have access to health care. That's kind of one of our traditional missions, but I would also say that we also serve the entire public in public health, and people may not think about this, but we touch people every day in their lives. So if you go out to eat in a restaurant, if you buy groceries at a store, if you breathe clean air, if you're free from outbreaks, those are all things that public health has had a hand in making your life better and hopefully improving your health.
Compared to previous times, the Middle Ages and whatnot, where raw sewage ran down the streets, and so the public health has become a factor in our lives,
right,
that allows us to have the lives that we live today. I want to get to the phone and talk to Amy from Lexington in just a quick moment. But I did want to, with Dr. Craig Humbaugh, you talk about the cost of health care and the controversy around the Affordable Care Act and the potential that it could be socialized medicine. I get emails all the time from companies saying, you can buy pharmaceuticals from Canada, where I understand, you know, things are a lot less expensive in places like Canada. Why can't we just buy pharmaceuticals from Canada or from one of these countries where they have a socialized medical program, and folks seem to be generally doing okay, and they're getting their medications from those countries? Are there problems with that? Can I respond to one of those emails, and will my doctor get me a prescription to buy me something out of Canada?
Well, in our country, as you know, the Food and Drug Administration has oversight over the pharmaceuticals that are recommended or authorized to be used by doctors and by patients. And I think that's the whole national federal system for making sure that drugs are safe in our country.
Our question, actually, I guess Amy didn't want to stay on the line. And when you do call in, we do encourage you to stay on the line. Then you can follow up and get your question directly answered. But she asks, how are health professionals coping with problems of people doing their own research on the internet, specifically with vaccinations? People get on the internet and jump to conclusions. And vaccinations, another hot button. People talking about infant vaccinations and people choosing not to take the measles, mumps, rubella vaccinations and things of that nature.
So I think healthcare and health information is no different from other types of information on the internet. There's a lot of misinformation about health that is posted on the internet. And so I always encourage people to go to trusted sources like health department websites and CDC and the National Institutes of Health, Mayo Clinic, and those types of sites for good, strong, evidence-based health information.
800-621-8890 is our number. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com, or send a tweet at WEKU EST. On this Thursday morning, Dr. Craig Humbaugh, Lexington Fayette County Health Commissioner, is live with us. This is your opportunity to interact with him, and there are just 9 minutes remaining in the program, so please feel free to get on the line at 800-621-8890. Just coming back to that issue about vaccinations, that is a hot button, and it's a very controversial kind of an issue. As a public health professional, how do you react to that, to to parents who take that kind of approach and say, and again, I know the figures are very tiny, but every once in a while, some child, some infant is vaccinated, and there are serious repercussions, maybe even death as a result. If that's, and some parents will say, I don't want to even take that amount of a chance. How do you react to that? What do you say to the parents dealing with that question?
Yeah, It's a great question. John, you probably also know that I'm a pediatrician as well. So it's
actually
a question
I didn't know that.
Dear to my heart. And I really think that the best response is they're exactly right. No medicine or no vaccination that we take, even when we take something for our headache, for instance, is totally without risk. But again, the data are there showing that the risk of vaccine-preventable diseases is much higher than the risk of the vaccine itself, so the protection that it provides. Now, some people might say, well, we very rarely see some of these childhood diseases that, you know, 100 years ago or 50 years ago were much more prevalent in the United States. And that is true because of the success that vaccinations have had in our community. But I would also say we live in a much more global community than we've ever lived in before. And every day there are people coming from other countries of the world to Kentucky and vice versa. We're going as Kentuckians to other places in the world where these diseases like measles, mumps, German measles, and others are still, and whooping cough, are still circulating on a routine basis. So it's much easier in some ways for germs to get here than they have ever had the opportunity in the past because of our global world and global economy and transportation being easier than ever.
What's happening with antibiotics? I have heard for years, probably the last couple of decades, that we were one of these days going to find that antibiotics no longer work because we overuse them, and that they've been overprescribed and physicians have overused them, or people have asked for them more than necessary. Are we facing a crisis there?
We are, certainly, that healthcare-associated infections are becoming more and more of a concern for us in this country as well as other developed countries. You're exactly right. The way bugs become resistant to commonly used medicines is overuse or inappropriate use of the medication. So our listeners as consumers can avoid that by always taking their antibiotic as prescribed by their physician or by their healthcare provider and not necessarily asking for an antibiotic every time that they go to the doctor. So antibiotics are only helpful for folks who have bacterial infections. They only work against bacteria. They're not effective against viruses, and there are many viruses that cause us to be ill. In fact, a common cold, for instance, is a virus. Antibiotics do not work effectively against that. So if we overuse antibiotics, then when we have folks who are really very sick in our tertiary care centers and in our hospitals, we're less likely to be able to effectively use the antibiotics that we have, and it's becoming more and more of an issue for us in this country.
What is the healthcare profession doing to prepare for that? I mean, is there work going on behind the scenes that will perhaps replace the antibiotics we have today?
Well, right now there's work going on in the hospitals and healthcare community, long-term care facilities to appropriately use antibiotics and also to track resistant infections and find out where they are and how we can contain those. But in the long term, you're right, we also have to think potentially about new antibiotics and the development of new antibiotics that might work in a different way and that might also be helpful. So there are many different ways that we can potentially attack this problem. But there again, prevention is almost always better than trying to cure the problem. So if we can keep bugs from developing resistance to antibiotics in the first place, we're going to be better off.
With the 2 minutes we have remaining in this week's Eastern Standard, Dr. Craig Humbaugh, what are we going to see out of your health department at Lexington, Fayette County in the next months or the next year or so? Is there a push or is there something very specific we're going to see happening very early in your term as health commissioner?
Well, I'm going to be very focused as an epidemiologist on data from the community. I'm going to use that data to help us drive where we're going in the future in Lexington and in Fayette County. But for the immediate future, we'll be doing some of the same things that we talked about today. There'll be continued pushes to eliminate mosquito breeding grounds because there are concerns about Zika. We'll be continuing to sustain our needle exchange program, which has grown even over this summer, and we'll also have increased outreach programs. We haven't even mentioned those: maternal child health, community education programs as we go forward.
Where do we go for reliable health information? Is that part of your job, too, is informing the public?
It is.
And
it is.
I guess
part
providing
of our
reliable
job
sources besides those places people
to
go.
To do health assessments and make sure the community knows where the gaps are in health and where we could improve and where we have improved. But it's also to make sure people know how they can go for various services that might be related to their health. They can go to our website. We're also very active in social media as well. So I encourage that. They can also go to the State Health Department's website, where I used to work, or to the CDC's website, all great sources of information.
And we'll make sure that we have links to those sites posted.
And for other local health departments as well, have good sites.
Okay. We'll make sure we provide some links on our website with our posts for this week's Eastern Standard. Dr. Craig Humbaugh, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us this morning. I hope we'll make this a more of a regular opportunity to interact on what's going on. And, of course, we're always grateful when you interact with our news department and keep us informed about what's happening in Lexington and Fayette County. Anything comes up, stay in touch. Let us know.
All right. Thanks for the chance to be here today, John.
That's it for this week's Eastern Standard with Dr. Craig Humbaugh. He is a health commissioner for Lexington and Fayette County. Our program is a production of the WEKU stations at Eastern Kentucky University. Associate producers are Marissa Hempel and Brian Burkhart, with help from Grant Willoughby. Brian Bartlett has been on the phones today. And a reminder that this show is available online, should be available early this afternoon at weku.fm. You can listen to it online or download the podcast. We encourage you to continue the conversation online at the WEKU website at weku.fm or on the WEKU Facebook page. We're always interested in your questions, your comments, your personal stories. React to our programs and our news stories on the website or write to us, WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter. We have an increasing Twitter following, and we're just about at 300 Twitter followers for the program right now. We'd like to take that over the top very soon. We'd love to hear from you at WEKU EST. I'm John Hingsbergen for Eastern Standard. Thank you for tuning in.